This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, we'll fill you in on a food truck rally coming to the Cabot Trail. We'll tell you about four Cape Breton soldiers killed during D-Day and how they became war crime victims. And on The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall, his guest is photographer and documentary filmmaker Peyton Chisholm. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. The first Cabot Trail food truck rally is taking place later this month. People will be able to sample some local food, take in a hike, and enjoy the fall colors during this two-day event on October 26th and 27th. The food truck rally is a project of the Pan-Cape Breton Food Hub. Bobby Knox spoke to Food Hub Executive Director Alicia Lake.
I think it's an idea that a lot of people have had over the years and kind of been kicked around and talked about for many years. It was part of the culinary tourism strategy that Destination Cape Breton created several years ago. And this year there was a few more of us talking about it. And we said, you know what, let's just do it. Let's make 2019 the year of the Cabot Trail Food Truck Rally.
Well, and how many food trucks are we talking about? How many are participating?
Yeah, so one of the great things about this rally that we're doing is that we're partnering also with the local restaurants that are still going to be open in the season.
Okay.
So all together, if you count our local restaurants and our food trucks, we have about 13 people that are participating, or 13 businesses, I should say, that are participating.
Well, okay, so there's quite a selection.
Yes, and I say you can absolutely sample something from all 13 of those locations over the 2 days of the rally.
And
so that's my challenge that I'm going to try to do myself, and I'm challenging everyone else to try also.
To get to all 13.
All 13, that's right. It'll be a struggle, but we can do it. We're
so, tough. Well, and just to explain a little bit more about how this works. You have 13 vendors, and they're located along the Cabot Trail, and this thing starts on a Saturday, the 26th.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're actually having an opening kind of concert celebration on the Friday evening at Periwinkle Cafe, and that's at 7 p.m. And then on Saturday and Sunday mornings, the rally will be starting at 10 a.m., running all day until 4 p.m. So the idea is that you can go to all the different locations, get a snack, go and do another hike. So the whole idea is really this hike, eat, and repeat. So all of the local restaurants that are participating have some specials. So Danina's Bakery and Bistro, I know, is doing a nice seafood chowder. I know that the Periwinkle is going to do a crab sandwich. Then we're also having the joint food truck is going to be at the Cody Tompkins Memorial Library in Margaree, and they're going to be offering their regular menu, but also pizza kits on Saturday. And this is a really exciting thing because the community oven at the Margery Library is going to be open, which is a brick oven that's wood-fired. Very exciting, very cool project.
Yeah, I think I've heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, it's just super, like really great community event. You get to actually watch your pizza cooking in open flame. Mm. So it's very, very cool.
Pizza in a wood-fired oven.
Wow. It's very, very cool project. Bobby, you have to go and do that one. But the joint is going to be selling some pizza kits that have some local ingredients, and then they're going to be helping people figure out how to stretch the dough and get those pizzas into the oven. So that's really exciting too.
Yeah, and I bet they'll cook quickly because those ovens get pretty hot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, neat. And you mentioned hiking. So it's not just eating. Hiking is part of this as well?
Yeah, that's right. So as you know, this is a wonderful time of the year to do hiking. And sometimes people forget that, you know, there still is great hiking at the end of October. So the idea is that we can, kind of have food near where all these great hikes are. And that way people can really enjoy, you know, not just the food, but also burning the food off on one of these great hikes that we have.
And what are some of the examples of some of the places people can go hiking?
Yeah, so for an example, the Skyline Trail, which is one of the most famous trails, I think, in Cape Breton. And we're going to have a food truck right on the trail. So that's really exciting. And then over on the Inganish side, there's, you know, lots of great hikes there. We'll have Stand and Stuff Your Face at Blackbrook Beach, which is kind of central to a lot of the different hikes in that area too. So that's exciting. And we're going to have the Bungalow Beans, which is a coffee food truck, and they're going to be up in Big Interville Campground, which is also like really central to a lot of fabulous hikes. So, you know, you can go do a great hike and then, you know, go grab a coffee, which is really exciting.
Okay. And as you say, this happens Saturday and Sunday, the 26th and 27th, and then do you have anything planned to wrap it all up when it's all over?
Yeah, we do. So we have a kind of a closing party happening at Big Spruce Brewing in the afternoon on Sunday. And they're going to have live music and beers. And that will be a really, really fun event also. And another really neat part about it is that we have passports that we'll be giving out to participants. So if they collect 5 stamps from different locations, they can enter those to win a really nice spring getaway package, which includes some really nice accommodations and dinners at restaurants.
Well, thanks for telling me about this today, and good luck with it.
Yes, and thank you for having me on.
Earlier this year, we told you about the 4 Cape Breton soldiers who landed on a Normandy beach codenamed Juno during D-Day 75 years ago. The 4 would become the victims of a war crime at the hands of SS troops. Craig Buckland from New Waterford researched their story.
I think, in fact, there may have been people that soldiers from Ontario or other province as well who ended up in the North Novas. It wasn't, if I'm not mistaken, certainly... many, for the most part, they were from Nova Scotia. It's one thing that, as you're talking about D-Day, just that it was surprisingly that I read that the North Novas actually didn't storm the beach on D-Day. They were part of the second wave.
That's right,
Backup that waiting in behind for orders or to see what areas needed support or secondary support. They actually came ashore without a lot of incident or without heavy losses, like, you know, obviously Juno be there, but the North Novas. And I think that was maybe what, you know, and the other side, things went well in the beginning, but then quickly changed, as so often does at the time.
Yeah, so they came in, landed later, and made their way inland, and I guess we begins
yes,
with these indeed. These 4 Cape Bretoners. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, I think, you know, because of the fact, I mean, June 6th, everything was going well into June 7th, and they were advancing, but a couple of different things going on at the time. Certainly, the SS division that was around the area, among others, they were at a distinct advantage because they knew the area so well. They had been living there and installed their defenses there for some time. So they had a clear view of the way the landscaping was there. They could see for miles that the Allied forces were approaching. And I think for the most part, they let them advance as much as they wanted and probably picked their spots for a few minor attacks towards the Canadians. But I think as they advanced, I think even the Canadians, they knew this is going a little bit too easy for us. Like they knew the Germans were probably watching and that they were somewhere along the line, but they just couldn't tell where. And as they advanced, well, there was they had taken some casualties, but nothing serious. And then there was a couple things going on. I think as any attacking force would do, they would send over, platoons or parties of scouting groups that would, they were looking to see what was out there. And I guess at that time, because a lot of the tanks were knocked out of commission, one of the things the Germans liked to do was go out at night and actually take back those tanks and repair them and get them back into service. And they were very good at that. And at the same time, from what I read, they were also looking for prisoners to interrogate and maybe get some information out find some information on maybe the size of the forces that were coming ashore and how, what exactly they could find out from a prisoner at that time. And, of course, the SS that were at the Abbey of Ardennes at that time, they were known as being, the baddest of the toughest sort of thing, German soldiers. They weren't your regular army. These guys were radicals, so to speak, and they were highly trained and very good at what they did.
And they were, I guess, Hitler fanatics as well. I guess they've been described. And this unit, they were young. They were teenagers, right?
Yeah, it was noted that there was a couple. There was actually a Polish soldier who had deserted the SS, and he provided the Canadians with some information, not only about the fact that, yes, that he was around when at least several of them were taken out back and executed. He heard the gunshots, and he knew at that time that they were, in fact, executed. The powers that be at the time among the SS, Kurt Meyer at the time, he really asked, they kept capturing all these prisoners, and I think upwards of 150, 160 prisoners in all total. And eventually he said, why are you bringing me back so many prisoners, sort of thing. And in other words, it was the first of maybe encouraging his non-commissioned officers or his lower officers that, hey, no more prisoners. And the fact is, we're losing our soldiers. And I think it was insinuated that in not so many words that, no more prisoners or let's do away with what we have.
And these guys, too, would have looked a little bit different from the regular German forces. I mean, they had camouflage smocks and they, machine gun pistols, and they were better equipped than the regular forces. So,
and I think, their leadership was well experienced in that type of warfare. And when you're installed and you've been there for a while, you can basically see who's coming at any time of the day. And let's not forget, there was a couple of factors there. Not only that, but the Germans, of course, their artillery at the time was the famous 88. That was just part of it. The 88s were that accurate and that good that it was just a superior weapon at the time. And then, of course, we can go into, the tanks itself, whether it was the Sherman tank versus the German Panzers, or some of the superior armor that they had at the time, because really it was there was a difference. Certainly, even that time of the war, the German armor was definitely a step above ours.
Yes, yeah, and could easily penetrate the Sherman tanks that the Allies were using. So we're still June 7th here.
Yes,
the North Novies moving inland.
Yes.
Let's continue along the story here.
Just the fact, I think, as usual, they were moving ahead, and there was at least one group that was captured in and around June 7th, And they're not really sure if they went out looking for their own prisoners, whether they were trying to scout the area. But in any case, a group of them were captured at that time and taken back to the abbey, or the Abbey Arden, which was basically a monastery, a medieval type of older church, almost like, with farm home houses and lots of gardens and chickens and cows and stuff like that. So it was a step back in time, really, the building itself. So the Germans were watching, and they were able to capture, without too much effort. Also, on at least on two different times, platoons were encircled in and around Authie, mm-hmm. And once they would be encircled or trapped, then word would go out, and then other Allied platoons or companies would try to rescue them or try to relieve them. And that's where the Germans were really good at counterattacking. Once they saw that, maybe they would put the bait out, sort of thing, that, okay, these guys are in trouble. We know the cavalry's coming, and when the cavalry comes, we're going to take on the cavalry, sort of thing. And I think that's what the Germans were really good at, just kind of counterattacking or waiting and hiding in the area, and then just ambushing. Again, so many Canadians had gone into the town on the outskirts of the abbey and just were overwhelmed by the German forces at the time. So many of them were, anytime they were surrounded like that, some of the wounded and whatnot, and were taken back to the abbey. So it wasn't just a soldier in good health who decided, all was lost to go back. It is recorded that some of the prisoners that were taken were also wounded soldiers. And in fact, from what I gather, some of those were also part of the 18 that were executed later on. So they were taken in, they were executed, they were, I guess Kurt Meyer at the time, he just decided he didn't have the time or patience to for all these prisoners. And once the word went out that some of them were going to be executed, I think one of the most touching things I read was that some of the prisoners who were lined up, and once they knew their fate, almost on defiance, they one by one they were being marched to the back courtyard and being shot in the back of the head or clubbed. That they actually exchanged pleasantries and shook hands and had a one last laugh or hug or whatever with their buddies before they were taken all back, even though they knew that the end was near. They still kept their chin up, sort of thing, and said, well, boys, we'll see you in a better life, sort of thing. And that was pretty sad to hear that.
Yes. And through your research, you discovered that the four Cape Bretoners who were among the North Novice, yes, who were taken prisoner were executed. And one of them was from your home community of New Waterford, Reginald Keeping.
He was a son of Wilson and Maud Keeping, and he was born in Burgio, Newfoundland, which happened to be the same town my grandfather was raised in, yeah, and lived in before he came to Sydney to work in the steel plant. Also, Joseph Francis McIntyre, age 28 at the time, son of Daniel and Florence, from Sydney Mine. Charles Doucette, who was 31, which would have been older than most of the soldiers at the time, for sure. Son of Mr. and Mrs. Peter Doucette, Mi'kmaq First Nation member too.
And we also had George Richard McNaughton from Sydney.
20, very much close to home. And as you said, Bob, that earlier on, most of the names I have, and whether you call it 18 soldiers or 20, because some were killed, at that time, some were killed the next day, and yet others, it's recorded, may have been executed a week or two later.
So there's a plaque at the Abbey with how many names on it?
I believe 18.
18.
18, I believe, and it is a bronze plaque erected by the French family. And what was amazing, Bob, is that we went there, as one of many tour groups, but it was, again, to see so many Canadian, little mini Canadian flags along the bottom, and even flowers, and, a little, maybe a painted rock with a Canadian flag on it saying, Je me souviens, I will remember. Wow. You see those sort of things. You're like, wow, people have come from far and abroad, and they have remembered. So that not only the French family who were responsible for putting up the plaque, but many, many others have come by to, to pay their respect to these fallen soldiers.
As you mentioned, you had a chance to visit, and you also heard from a member of the Vico family.
Yes. Jacques Vico was there, and he gave us he is quite a storyteller. He remembers, he was a boy at the time, but he remembers it vividly. And I think what happened was, it was actually afterwards. It wasn't at the same time. Obviously, the Germans were in control of the Abbey at the time, and some of the Vico family were moved out. At least one or more had been captured by the Gestapo as being part of the underground. And so, you know, the Germans, they just, at the time, naturally, they went in, they just took over and did what they had to do with the place. And they were, they were living there for some time, had done it after, you know, into 45, and it was actually after 45 that the Vico family had noticed some irregularities in the garden growing out back. Mm. And the Mrs. Vico wondered, you know, what's going on there? You know, had the Germans done something? And they took a shovel and just by chance dug it up. And lo and behold, they found several bodies there at the time. And then as they went around, they continued to find more bodies. So it wasn't like they found 18 bodies at the same place. Mm. It was like five here and four there or whatever. And then eventually, of course, we're talking 45 and then after the war. Well, it's a little bit vague as to exactly how many they found in one place, but the facts remain that, you know, they were executed at the time. Mm. You can imagine that once word got out to the Canadian forces that, you know, they were pretty upset with this.
And, yes.
And, you know, some, there's a question as to whether, you know, there was any revenge taken later in the year or whatever towards German soldiers. I'm sure, I wouldn't be surprised as a soldier if you saw some of your best buddies or heard that they were executed cold blood. Revenge would perhaps be on your mind, as other things.
Yes, exactly. Kurt Meyer himself, he ended up being arrested and court-martialed and being found responsible for allowing these executions to take place.
Yes, and he was decorated. Just touch on for a second there. You know, as commander of the 25th Panzer Grenadier and 12th Panzer Division, a regiment of the 12th Panzer Division. He had won the Iron Cross, second class, and first class would be, you know, our equivalent of the Victoria Cross. Also the German Cross. So he really was one of their better leaders at the time, for sure. And in 45, he was actually brought to trial, and he denied any knowledge of the specific events in question. That being said, he was found guilty and sentenced to death originally. But then, as so often the case, things changed after that with regards to his sentence. General Chris Vokes, who was the responsible Canadian officer, said he really didn't deserve the death penalty, and that was our Canadian representative at the time who was dealing with this. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I believe life meant 20 years. So the first part of the sentence, Dorchester Penitentiary, and I believe it was commuted to 14 years. And then with good behavior, Meyer served somewhere around 8 or 9 years. There's an interesting story there, Bob. It's apparently, there was other SS members at Dorchester who had served, who were imprisoned at the time, and they were around. And some of his former SS soldiers actually developed a plan to free him from Dorchester. They really thought they could break him out because Kurt Meyer had a routine every day, and the same two guards, and they would allow him to exercise and to run because Kurt Meyer was a bit of a fitness buff, and they had, you know, over a period of time, you see routines, and they firmly believed that they could bust him out of Dorchester and get him out of there. Now, where you would go in New Brunswick, I'm not sure, but it's said that Kurt Meyer said, you know, no, I'm okay here, sort of thing. So he ended up doing about 8 years, but then he actually, when he, you know, did his time, he went back to the Abbey in person and spoke to the Vico family again. So imagine that after he had gone to trial, served his time, and then ended up back in France and went back to the Abbey for a visit in the late 50s. And Jean-Marie Vico, again, who was a lady there at the time, she said basically, you know, why did you lie, sort of thing? And he said the obvious answer. He said, you know, it's difficult for an officer to admit to an enemy court that such things had been done. He said, so, you know, yeah, well, I lied at the time. But
so he admitted responsibility out of court.
Yeah, and you know, anybody under him would have said, you know, hey, soldier takes orders and does what he's told, sort of thing. And that's what his, you know, commissioned officers or whatever, and that's who he tended to blame. He said, you know, it was a non-commissioned officer who did something, and I banished him to an outpost immediately following that, and he was killed. Now, we don't know way of confirming that, of course, but I suppose if we can give him a little bit of credibility in that, you know, the obvious way out sort of thing, in that, you know, one of my rogue officers or non-commissioned officers decided to do this, and I may or may not have known about it, sort of thing. But the fact he went back to the Abbey, I thought, was pretty interesting, like a lot of nerve, basically, to go back there, and where, you know, the Vico family knew what had happened, because Canadians had sent representatives from the government over there to continue some of the grave digging and determining, you know, because, you know, before the days of DNA, it was a little bit harder to determine, you know, based on remains in a grave, you know, who exactly the person was. Were they Canadian? Yes. Were they with the North Novas? Or were they from a different regiment or army at the time?
Time now for The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall. This week, Paul's guest is photographer and documentary filmmaker Peyton Chisholm.
Why don't you tell us about just some other things you've done, and then we're going to get into talking about your latest project.
Sure.
Okay?
Okay. One project that was very special was I got to shoot a lot of video just before the steel plant closed down. So some of the footage from that is Project Elizabeth Beaton started, and some of that footage was used in a National Film Board film, right? The making, shaping, and treating of steel, right? So that was a nice project, and I got a camera credit in that production. And then I've done a lot of other little documentary videos. I worked at the cable station in Sydney when it started in the community programming, you know? And then did some work at the university at the Mi'kmaq Resource Center when that started also, and later on with that, and kind of finished up my full-time working career at Unamagi College as coordinator of communications with them for 2 years.
So you've been around images for a long time then.
Yeah.
And you do a lot of photography, somewhat as a hobby, right?
Yeah, it's a hobby right now. Yeah. I started walking a lot, and then walking down at Mugga Creek. And then when I finished working full-time, I got a new digital camera and a couple of lenses and started taking the camera and lenses with me and doing some photography down there, and kept going back because it's a nice walk. It's close to where I live, and really enjoyed it, and came up with working with the idea of urban wildlife and seeing how the wildlife, especially the birds, were coming back to that area of Muggus Creek where the Tarpon Reclamation Project had gone on.
Yep. So you've over the past couple of years, then you've amassed these interesting photos, and because you've spent a lot of time down there, as you said, and it's gone. It's more than just Peyton taking pictures that he likes. It's actually turned into a bit of a project now, and you've had one showing of this thing at CBU a few weeks ago.
Yeah,
and what? And you're calling it Open Hearth 3.0.
No, I call it Mugga Creek 3.0.
Okay, tell us about it, and then what 1.0 and 2.0 would have been.
Yeah. Well, the first part I'd look at is what was there directly from nature without any human interference, right? And it probably was a place that the Innu, the Mi'kmaq, Cape Breton were. And because it's a freshwater source into the harbor, I mean, who knows who all visited that area, right? And then at the turn of the 20th century was when the steel mill was built. And then, of course, a lot of pollution happened there. They basically ended up with a chemical soup in that waterway that couldn't be treated, really, and decided to do that reclamation project, right? And since then, they've opened up the waterway a bit more. It's kind of a Barishwa tidal pool was there before, and historically it was called Wintering Pond or whatever, so sailboats would come in and winter there. And now it seems to be in its third stage of going back to being a nature area, if you will, right? It seems to me that there's some plant life coming back and bird life coming back. That kind of tidal area seems to be robust with snails. And, I mean, we have pictures of seagulls and crabs and double-crested cormorants with looks like an eel type thing to me. So it seems to be pretty rich and abundant in food.
I should say that ever since the Tarpons was cleaned up and then it was named Open Hearth, and you can sometimes mention this to people like all the influx of international students, and they don't know what you're talking about, but even younger people, the whole concept of the Tarpons, that doesn't exist in their mind anymore.
No.
So the area where, for those that may be listening, don't know, this is in the north end of Sydney. An official name is the Open Hearth Park, and it's many hectares big, and this was part of the whole Tarpons, but which was once time was Muggus Creek. And we should add that your family home, you grew up literally across the street from there, right?
Well, it's like Alec McGuinness said at one time, you know, he went to bed with his head on the pillow and his feet in Mugga Creek, where he lived on Inner Colonial Street. So it was pretty much the same for us, where we live. And now to go down there and just walk and see all the wildlife. And it was a big part of my life growing up in Sydney, and, you know, in my youth and in my adult life. And now you walk down there, and the other day I was down talking to a person who was visiting and had to explain to him where the steel plant was and that there was a coke ovens there and everything, because except for a few artifacts from the steel plant that were there, you would, if you just come in town and go down there and walk there, you'd never realize what was there. There's interpretive panels and everything, but physically when you look at it, there's nothing to show that there was a steel plant there, a basic steel mill where you're using iron ore and limestone and everything to make steel, make iron and then make steel. So none of that exists there anymore.
Yeah, and that lasted for 80 to 90 years.
Yeah, I think it was pretty much, it was almost a full century from when it started to when it really finished. Now, the basic steel operation finished earlier, but still they were running a melt shop for a couple of decades or something. So,
So
that's the site.
So let's go back 20 years then, or into the 1990s when, you know, there was all this talk and wrangling between the different levels of government about who's going to clean it up, are we going to clean it up, will it get cleaned up? And there were many people then that felt it would never get cleaned up, right? And if it did, it would never turn into anything of any use to anybody. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say that was the situation, and it was hard to get a grip on how they were going to clean it up also, because my understanding, it was a chemical soup. It wasn't simple like some sites where it were specific toxins that were there, because you had chemicals from the steel mill, the steel making process, and from coke ovens, right? So the coke ovens process is basically taking gas out of coal to be used to make steel. So where do all those chemicals go? A lot of them leached into that waterway, and over a period of time, it became that chemical soup.
So now when you walk down along the lovely trails,
the beautiful shores of Mugga Creek.
Yes, but it's, we can say, and say, really? But it is.
Yeah, and I think you can look across North America and look in, you know, the United States, places like New Jersey and that, and see what they called in the 80s and 90s Superfund sites in the United States, that they went in and cleaned them up and used the technology of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is it was a very costly project. They kind of had two or three starts at it. The initial thing was they were going to burn it in the blast furnace, or the open hearth furnaces, right? And then
they built an incinerator.
They built an incinerator also, yeah. Right? But then they had transportation issues with that. And I mean, there was a lot of money spent on different engineering ideas, concepts before they came up with the final one, which resulted in a lot of remediation of the properties and then some creating green space, which it's pretty much is today.
So part of your photo project that you're going to be exhibiting, and
yes,
hopefully at different places,
sure,
people will get a chance to see this. So a lot of the urban wildlife you see are birds.
Yeah.
That 20, 30, 40 years ago, you'd be lucky to see a starling down around there.
Well, I don't know. I've heard different reports that they did an environmental study beforehand, mm-hmm, and that they did bird counts and things like that there. Now, I don't know if they necessarily took any specimens to see what was happening with them, but there was probably a similar amount of birds there at some point that there is now.
Mm-hmm.
And all that type environmental information is in the tarpon studies they did and reviews and everything like that. I haven't gone through that. This project for me sort of started when I was walking there with what was there then, which
right,
was after the remediation had been, mm-hmm, done. But as I go down, it seems every year I'm seeing a few more birds and things like that, and the area seems to be coming back as best it can with what's there.
Right. So, and part of what you're doing is also is to encourage people to use the site, because that's,
yeah,
what it was built for. It wasn't,
yeah,
it wasn't designed for people not to go to. So why don't you? What are some of the birds that you can see? Like if you were ambling down there this afternoon, or
this time of year, you'll certainly see some gulls and maybe some terns, and if you're lucky, still some blue herons as the day goes on. I think if you look around Sydney Harbour too, you'll see lots more blue herons there. So it's a sign that that site's coming back, at least for the birds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also some foxes that are around there now. Occasionally, there's been a deer come through there, loons, lots of other, depending on the time of the year when the birds are moving, like this time of year, we might see some mergansers or something like that. There are also, yellow-eyed?
Ducks?
Ducks,
types?
Yeah, different types of ducks, yeah, and stuff like, mm-hmm, that.
It's ironic you mentioned the blue heron, because when we're talking about that incinerator they built,
yeah,
do you remember the dredge? There was a dredge,
yeah,
and the dredge was going to take the material and transport the incinerator, and the dredge was called the blue heron.
Exactly, yeah, right? There was a lot of branding around the blue heron with,
yeah,
the tarpons cleanup, and,
yeah,
one of their taglines is, you know, we will see blue herons again in Muggis Creek, right? And
but which we are.
No one believed it at the time,
right,
but we are now. So,
yeah,
so that's why, for me, going down there, seeing these birds, taking photographs of them, and seeing this area come back to life, is that I was trying to celebrate that,
yes,
in this project.
Mm-hmm.
So the project, the general idea, Mugga Creek 3.0, was how it is now.
Right.
So I had a group of photos. I wasn't interested in spending or developing a narrative as that this is a rehabilitated site, as this is a site now that you can go to this afternoon, right, with your partner or family or children,
yep,
or pets or whatever,
mm-hmm,
right? And have a walk down there and have a nice, enjoyable, relatively peaceful place, right?
Yeah, and part of the Mugga Creek 3.0 you have a friend, John Hugh Edwards,
yeah,
who's a poet,
yeah,
and he's written, he's always shows up in a different place, or I hear about every couple of years with some,
yeah,
really neat stuff he's done. So he's written 10 or a dozen or so poems that you gave him some of the images.
Yeah, then, what happened is we were having a discussion, and I was saying that people who I had talked to about this project and had seen some of the images were saying, oh, you got to sell this as it's a rehabilitated site from the tar ponds. And I said, well, that's not a narrative I want to engage with, right? That type of historical narrative. I just want to do what I'm doing and recognize that these things happen, but that's not what I'm about here, right? And the idea at the time was I wanted to do an exhibit of the pictures and have them mounted on steel or printed on steel plate or aluminum or whatever, and have an exhibit of these 10 images I had come up with, right? And he said, well, why don't you send me one of the images? I'll look at it, and maybe I'll write a poem about it, and we'll see how that goes. So I think it was the winter of 2017. I started sending him an image after in January of 2017.
Right.
He'd send me back a poem, and then I'd send him another image, and he'd send me back another poem, and we went like that. And then we got it to the point where we had 10 images that I had picked and 10 poems, and we were looking at having them printed on metal and doing something with that, and that it would be an exhibit of these images and these poems about this specific area. So there you go. That was it. So we did that, put it together, and then started investigating how to have these images printed and displayed.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea I was working with at that time, and still am to an extent, is that the images of the birds would be life-size. So when you have a blue heron, you need a fair-size image. Coincidentally, through a small exhibit I did of three of the photos at the university, I think it was last November for an environmental conference that was being streamed in. People took notice of those, and with Professor Terry Gibbs and Tracy Harris, they had another project that this dovetailed with, and they wanted to get a picture of the blue heron. So I said, okay, that's fine. I'll see if I can get that done. And they wanted to place it in a stairwell, so we had lots of room to use, and we came up with a 4 by 6 foot image of the blue heron printed on vinyl and mounted it on metal aluminum and then put on the wall. So that was the first
one
that was that size. I had experimented with printing on metal with the heron and with another image of a seagull and a crab, and was very satisfied what I was getting there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the first one in a public display, and hopefully there will be some accommodation for some of the other ones to be printed and eventually displayed there, maybe all as a group of 10 or individual images in different places at different times, right?
Okay, so we couldn't, John Hugh wasn't available to come in
no.
to read with the poems, but
right.
we have the poems that accompany it, so
sure.
And we've been talking about the great blue heron, so why
yeah.
don't you why don't you read this one for our listeners?
Okay, this is a great blue heron, which is goes with portrait of the heron taken at Mugga Creek. Great blue heron. She stands apart, knee bent in nonchalance, her lunch hanging like a long ash cigar, her presence a lesson in indifference. But she watches. Through the cast iron gaze of her bronze and coal black eyes, she watches. And that poem was written by John Hugh Edwards.
And it's a lovely little piece, and most of them are all, they're not too long.
Nope.
But they're like a companion to the photograph.
Yes.
And I think
exactly.
that's what they're meant to be.
Yeah.
And so this one, I've seen this picture,
yeah.
Photograph, and it's in Sea Wing, Campus Center. So if you're at CBU, just in back of the cafeteria, there's a stairwell up.
That's right.
And
yep.
you can't miss it.
You can't miss it. No.
And it's very striking. And on the metal, it's quite neat.
Yeah, no, yeah. It was done, it was printed by Seven Signs, and they did an excellent job, and they installed it. I was really happy with the reproduction. You're always taking a chance when you have an image and you make it that size that it's going to look blurry or pixelate or whatever, mm-hmm. but that image is sharp as a tack as a 4x6 image,
so
which you don't see very often either, anything that big.
Yeah. I think really the idea of the life size is pretty neat.
Yeah.
There'll be quite a juxtaposition, though, if you ever find a hummingbird or something down there.
Right, yeah. No, the hummingbird would be pretty small. But then the Canada geese also. I have one in Canada geese that's in part of this series, which will be pretty big, too. That'll end up being probably 4x6 feet as a horizontal, right?
Yep. So when you were at CBU, you presented the exhibit at first. It was like about 4 to 5 minutes of just photographs, images.
Exactly.
Which is quite nice.
Yeah.
No sound, no nothing, just the pictures. So you sit back and enjoy them.
Yeah.
Then there's the 10. The 10 with the...
that make up the Mugga Creek 3.0 project. Right,
the project, yes.
In a PowerPoint.
With the poetry.
With the poetry.
Which you let people read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that seemed to work all right. I was wondering how that was going to work myself, because presenting things to people now, it seems to be short. Everyone's used to watching 20-second videos on YouTube, so something that's even just 4 minutes is kind of taxing people. Having people read on screen, too, is an old skill, it seems, you know, although we're reading on small screens every day.
Yes.
So that seemed to work well, and the group of people there seemed to be very appreciative and seemed to get into the project, which was a very nice feeling. And then we had another piece I showed, which was it's probably only 90 seconds or something like that, which is is a video that I'm working on. And we had a graduate of CBU, Matt Moore, who works in the radio communications business now in Nova Scotia, and he voiced a poem for us when we were looking at that at the time. Mm-hmm. So that was part of that, part of the video.
Right.
And I used the sort of format of the text over the images for the first part, and then he read a poem as the end of that. So that seemed to be appreciated, too. So that might be something that we'll do a little more work on as to maybe having different people voice it or something like that.
Do you have internet site or Facebook site or something where you show some of the pictures?
No, I haven't.
You're holding off on
that? I haven't done that yet.
Right.
I've been focusing on this other part of the exhibit part of it.
Yeah.
It'd be easier for some of that stuff to transfer now, like with the PowerPoint, but it just hasn't been a focus yet.
And there is something nice about the exhibit concept and people having to come out to see what it is. It's like a little presentation. It's what you're doing, and you're interested, and we're hopeful that, now that you've started with this, there'll be other opportunities.
Yes, yes.
And if one of our listeners was interested in what Peyton Chisholm is working on, what's in the maybe wanting to use this at an event or something? How do they email easy way
I'm
to get
the,
you?
I'm in the book.
You're in
they
the book.
They can contact me at rollingmill@ns.simpatico.ca.
Right.
You know, I know a few people in the community around here, so I'm usually pretty easy to find.
Yeah, yeah. Peyton is well known denizen of Sydney area. So so that's great. So why don't we wrap it up with one more? Maybe the poem about the crab. It's a nice way to end.
This one, my personal favorites, the gull and the crab. The gull and the crab, in the violent clashing of carapace and claw, the shuddering moment meets nature's own law. We may see our life's purpose in the gull's thrusting grab. But when the drama is over, we will surely be the crab.
Yeah. Okay, Peyton, thanks for coming in.
And that's our show for today. As always, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.